given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up hope and you're down in despair. When you've given up.
Welcome to Illuminations. I'm Renee Morin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Deanne Phillips.
This is a show about people making ripples in the spirit sphere in the 21st century. From ancient history to modern-day innovations, we are unpacking the stories of all kinds of interesting subjects, people, and events. We're going to the very soul of the matter, and we're bringing it to you.
Thank you for joining us for Illuminations today on Red River Radio. Today we have with us Shane Claiborne. Shane is a best-selling author, an international speaker, an activist, and an advocate for social justice. He founded The Simple Way in Philadelphia and heads up Red Letter Christians. Some of Shane's books include The Irresistible Revolution, Red Letter Revolution, Jesus for President, and Executing Grace. Shane, thank you for being here with us.
Yeah, glad to be your guest. Thanks for having me.
I think we should probably begin at the beginning. How novel, right? So can you tell us about your childhood and your roots and all that?
Well, sure. Yeah, I grew up down in East Tennessee in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains. Actually, I just found this out, but I think it was my great-great-grandfather was the postman by horseback through like the mountains. And I fell in love with Jesus down here. You know, it's the Bible Belt. So I had a altar call, kind of born again experience. And that's, you know, shifted and reoriented the rest of my life. But I also began to wrestle with a lot of the history of our country. I mean, literally just not far from here is where the Trail of Tears started. I'm in Tennessee right now, you know, near where I grew up visiting my mom. And the Trail of Tears is here. We've got, you know, a lot of historic monuments and memorials to the Civil War. And in my high school, we were the Maryville High School Rebels, and we had the Confederate flag on everything. It was on our lunchroom trays. It was painted on murals on our walls. It was on football uniforms. So I just began to see some of these, the residue of racism. As much as I love the South and sweet tea and Southern hospitality, I started to wrestle with some of those things. So I really wanted to study about my faith, and I wanted to study about the world that we live in. So I went to Philadelphia to study sociology and to study the Bible. And boy, you know, I like how Karl Barth, he was one of the great thinkers of the church, and he said, we've got to read the Bible in one hand, but we need to read the newspaper in the other. So our faith doesn't just become a ticket into heaven and an excuse to ignore the world that we live in right now. So I really believe that, you know, my faith fuels so much of what I do right now. And when I look at Jesus, he wasn't just talking about going to heaven when we die. He was talking about bringing the kingdom of God on earth while we live, you know, bringing God's dream down. So that fuels a lot of my activism and work these days.
Can you tell us about when you were at seminary and your special summer vacation that one year? I know you know what I'm talking about, Mother Teresa.
Yeah. Well, right. So when I was in undergrad, when I was in college, we had this real longing to see a more faithful discipleship, because it became very clear to me that one of the biggest obstacles to Christ is Christians, you know, who have all the bumper stickers and t-shirts, but we don't always have the love. And Christian, the word Christian means Christ-like. I think that a lot of the church is better at making believers than forming disciples or forming people that live and love like Jesus did in the world. So when we started, you know, looking at the landscape of what's going on in the church and in the world, we really were fascinated by Mother Teresa, who is one of those exemplary, you know, beautiful kind of lights in the world. And she was still alive in the late 90s. And so when you're 19 years old, no one's convinced you that anything's impossible, you know. So we just wrote her a letter, old school snail mail, you know, and sent it and didn't hear back. And we got a little fidgety because the summer was approaching, and we wanted to work with her. And so we, you know, we started, I just started calling nuns on the phone and I got one nun. Some of them hung up on me, but I got one nun that gave me a phone number. I called it, and Mother Teresa picked up the phone, and you know, the rest is history. But we went over there and we worked with her, and you know, I was in prayer most every morning with her at 5 o'clock in the morning. I worked in the home for the dying, which was Mother Teresa's first home, where literally we'd go into the streets and lift people off the streets who were dying. We'd bring them into the home and we'd take care of them. You know, we would massage their muscles and eat with them and sing with them. And, you know, the point was not necessarily to keep someone alive, but to allow them to die with dignity and with love and with someone holding their hand. So it was very holy and exhausting work. I also worked in the orphanages, you know. So Mother Teresa used to say, what's important is not how much we do, but how much love we put into doing it. We're called to do not great things, but small things with great love. So that experience in India, and I went back after she died again, but that it really, really shaped who I am and in our community in Philadelphia that I've been a part of for the last 22 years.
Sounds like you brought back a little Mother Teresa inside of you.
Well, that love sure is contagious, you know, and one of the things that she said was that you don't have to go to Calcutta, you know, Calcutta, India, to find Calcutta. She said, Calcuttas are everywhere. So pray that God would give you the eyes to see those who are hurting, those who are lonely, those who don't have anybody holding their hand, and you don't have to go across the world to do that. So she, you know, she really sort of commissioned people out with that message to find those who are in need of love. And you know, racism, inequity, injustice, all that has its own face anywhere we are.
She had a specific viewpoint on right to life as well, didn't she?
Yeah, she's one of those that I've been inspired in my thinking about the dignity of all life, you know, and often called the consistent life ethic, you know, from womb to tomb. And I came to find out that, you know, for a lot of my life, I talked about being pro-life, but I really was only thinking about the issue of abortion. And I began to see that, you know, the irony in America is that you can say you're pro-life and still be pro-guns, pro-death penalty, pro-war, you know, and anti-life on every other issue. So I wanted a, you know, a more robust ethic of life. And Mother Teresa had it. You know, she was passionately against abortion, but she was also passionately against the death penalty and would call governors up the night before executions, you know, and she had this just beautiful value for life from womb to tomb. So that's, and she, you know, she didn't just have bumper stickers and t-shirts. She didn't just hold signs. She took in children that were abandoned in train stations. And I know because I met them, you know, I met this like kid that was about my age. He was probably 20 years old at the time when I met him. And he said, you know why we call her mother, right? And I said, tell me. He said, because she's our mom. She raised me. And he started showing me all these things that Mother Teresa had given him growing up. And I mean, just like a mom, you know, and he said, literally many of us were, you know, abandoned in the streets or the train stations. And she took us in, and that's how she became known as Mother Teresa. She's like that old, you know, the mother in the shoe with so many kids, she didn't know what to do. So she, but that, you know, that also, you know, it just inspired me. Cause I think if more people that wanted to reduce abortions took in, you know, 14-year-old moms and adopted children, I think that's it's just a, it's got teeth on it, you know. And so I really love I love Mother Teresa and how she lived. She said our best sermon is our life. So she was a woman of few words, but had a whole lot to preach with her life.
When you came back after being with her, was that when you founded the Simple Way?
Yeah, the things were already sort of stirring up a little bit, but we figured it was a good idea to finish college for most of us, you know. But while we were in college, and this is what prompted us to go to India, there was a group of homeless families in Philadelphia, mostly mothers and their children, that had nowhere to go. There were 3,000 families on the waiting list for housing. You know, they saw all these abandoned buildings that we have, and they chose a very particular one. They moved into an old abandoned Catholic church building and started living there. and out of desperation. And sadly, the response of the Catholic Church was that they were trespassing and they needed to get out, or they could, you know, they would be arrested. And so a group of us heard about that. We read it in the newspaper. And there's those times you kind of throw your hands up at God and you say, God, why don't you do something? And you hear God sort of say back, I did do something. I made you. Get down there. You know, so we went down, and on the front of the cathedral, listen to this, the families had hung a banner that said, how can we worship a homeless man on Sunday, Jesus, and ignore one on Monday? So that was, you know, it was instrumental. We became a part of that struggle for housing, and then we ended up starting the Simple Way out of that. So our community was inspired by these homeless moms. It was also inspired by Mother Teresa. You know, we read about the early church in the book of Acts in the New Testament. And interestingly enough, it says all the early Christians, they shared everything they had. No one claimed any of their possessions were their own. And it says there were no needy persons among them. They worshiped in their homes. And so it has this vision, instead of the mega church, of kind of this micro church, you know, this incredible community where possessions were held in common, where they were committed to loving their neighbor. And so we started our little community over 20 years ago. And now it's more like a village. We've got a whole bunch of properties, community gardens, murals, and we're sharing a lot of food right now during the pandemic. So we're doing what we can to try to love our neighbor as ourselves, and it's been a great few decades of doing that.
Could you tell us a little more about what the Simple Way does in the community and how they work within that community?
Absolutely. So we came in not really thinking of the programs we wanted to set up, but just trying to be good neighbors and listen to what people what we could build on, ideas, dreams that they had. And so we quickly became a place of hospitality. So we started taking in folks that were coming out of domestic violence, folks that were addicted to drugs. We've got a lot of heroin in our neighborhood. So we have a, you know, recovery community that we're connected with all folks that are recovering from drug addiction, substance addictions. We've got affordable housing. So we're taking those old abandoned houses and we're turning them into really beautiful homes for families. So we're doing all that. We help kids with homework. We love planting gardens, and we have an aquaponic system where we got fish and plants living together. We're building a new community center with some partners of ours that they're building that. So there's a whole lot of stuff we're doing, but we're also like addressing some of the fundamental justice issues. I like how Dr. Martin Luther King said, we're called to be the Good Samaritan. And lift our neighbor out of the ditch, you know, on the road to Jericho, talking about the story Jesus told. And he said, but Dr. King said, but after you lift so many people out of the ditch, you start to say, maybe we need to rethink the whole road to Jericho. You know, this isn't working. So, you know, when it comes to things like gun violence, almost every corner of our neighborhood has a memorial to the lives that have been lost to guns. And that becomes personal. You know, I had a 19-year-old that died in, you know, on our front steps. I was holding his hand as he was, you know, fighting for his last breaths. And there comes a moment where you sort of say, enough, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. And so just as we're going to give food to folks, we're going to ask why people are hungry. You know, just as we're trying to mentor young people, we're also going to ask questions about why we're losing 100 people every day to gun violence in America. So those issues, they're an extension of loving our neighbor as ourself. You know, I think I learned compassion from Mother Teresa, and I, in many ways, I've learned justice from Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, this idea that we've also got to interrupt the patterns that are squashing our brothers and sisters.
I did have a question. Like, while we were preparing for this show, a story came on the news right here in Shreveport about a 17-year-old boy who was a star football player at his high school, and he had all this opportunity ahead of him, college scholarships. And he drove a teammate home after practice. And on his way back, someone shot him while he was in his car. And I was wondering, what are some things you think that can help stop this kind of senseless violence?
That's heavy. I mean, I feel for that young man. I think every life that is lost is a child of God, made in the image of God. And I think God takes that personally. You know, we can do a better job at protecting life. I think of cars, which are not designed to kill. But they can. And so we've done so many things to try to protect people from, you know, the damage that can be done. We have speed limits, we have airbags, we have, you know, a license. If you misuse your car, you can lose your license. So we've done all these things to try to make people safe. And yet with guns, it's just the opposite. I mean, and guns are designed to kill. I think there's so many things that we could do. We've got to ask questions on the limits. You know, even the Second Amendment was written at a time when guns shot one round a minute. Now they shoot 100 rounds in a minute. And yet our thinking is often still not evolved at all. So I think like things, questions about should there be a capacity to how many rounds can be fired without reloading, semi-automatic weapons, you know, guns that are military style weapons that are designed to kill as many people as possible, as quickly as possible. Should they be on our streets? And the good news is that 80% of gun owners want to see some changes on things like high capacity weapons, background checks, domestic abusers being able to acquire weapons. So I'm really optimistic on it. I also think we are unprecedented in the rest of the world in that we have more guns than people. We've got 5 times more gun shops than McDonald's restaurants. You know, Jesus said, when you pick up the sword, you die by the sword. And I think literally we've got to do something about our obsession and our saturation of guns in our country. I mean, we've got about 4% of the world's population and almost half the world's guns. So incidentally, we just see more people dying from those guns. We see more police officers dying. We see more kids like the young person that you just described. I mean, gun violence is the number one cause of death of African American children. So I think this is a pro-life issue. 100 lives a day that are lost to guns. It just doesn't have to be that way. I don't think we're going to save every life, but I think we can do better. And one last thing is, I don't think it's just about legislation, but I think there's technology. Like, you know, we mentioned airbags with the cars. We have everything we need to create smart gun technology, except for the willingness of politicians and others to allow us to do that, so that guns could operate off of fingerprint technology. And that would prevent a lot of deaths from stolen guns, from someone that finds a gun in a house and, you know, a child or something. It wouldn't be able to operate without that fingerprint. It's not the gun owners that are the problem. I mean, half my family are gun owners. It's the gun extremists and the gun profiteers that are really kind of pushing this idea of fear and these unreasonable ideas that if they come for our AR-15s, they're going to come for our hunting rifles too. And that's not true.
So really what I hear you saying is that it's not just the guns, but it's the heart of the person who's holding the gun.
I absolutely believe it's both. You know, some folks say, well, it's not a gun issue. It's a heart issue. And I say it can be both, right? Like most issues are both, and no law can change a heart. You know, no law, you can't legislate love. You can't heal racism or violence in someone's heart. Only God can do that. But I also think like God heals hearts and people change laws. And in the civil rights era, we needed both, you know, like we needed racist hearts to change. We still need that. But we also needed laws to change so that folks could swim in the same swimming pools and go to the same schools and vote. And, you know, so I think that we could reflect those ideals in our legislation as well. So I think of it, you know, really as both. And Dr. King did that. You know, he said, a law can't make you love me, but it can keep you from killing me. So I do think that we can do better, you know, at protecting life when it comes to guns. Even things like there's one law that we've been, my friends have been really encouraging, which is called one handgun a month. It would allow for a person to have 12 handguns. These are just handguns a year, one per person per month. So you could have 12 per person a year. And there's still this lobby to stop that. And you're like, who needs more than 12 handguns in a year? I'll tell you, someone who's on handguns. So that's, I think those kind of laws, we just need some basic, you know, reasonable. That's why folks are saying real common sense gun laws that could help. And we need God to heal hearts as well.
So I want to get back to talk a little more about the Simple Way and the work you've been doing in that community in Philly. How is the Simple Way funded, first of all? Because I know it's a nonprofit.
Well, since we were inspired by the early church, we started just by pulling our money together, you know, and that was, we worked part-time jobs. We've always kind of been bivocational, working part-time jobs in order to fund the nonprofit, the work we do in the neighborhood. And I also write and speak, and that money fuels a lot of our work. All that money comes into the Simple Way, and then we do, you know, we fund a lot of other organizations, about 200 or so that we've supported. And we also, keep our work sustained in the neighborhood through that. But we have generous givers from all over the world that support what we do. So I'm so grateful. I mean, we have folks in prison that have sent $5 to us. We've got kids that have actually sent change, you know, in a jar to us. And we've got donors that, you know, can give $10,000. And so no matter what people give, we pray that, you know, it's how much love they put behind it. And we feel the love, you know, every day. So we're grateful for folks' support. And if folks want to, you know, support our local work, it's thesimpleway.org.
Do you feel like that this is something that could happen and grow in other communities as well?
Yeah, it's happening all over the world. In fact, we've sort of been the ones that were really inspired by other communities. We visited a different community every year when we were starting ours. So there's a whole network of communities. I think it's communityofcommunities.info. That's kind of a directory of different communities. But, you know, this stuff goes all the way back to the early church. And I think that's what's so important for us, is that I worked at Willow Creek in Chicago. You know, it's a large mega church. I've been in the big churches, but I'm really drawn to this idea of community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we, you know, especially in the pandemic, a lot of us are really longing for face-to-face community. And it's what we're made for. You know, we're made to love and be loved. We're made in the image of a God that reflects community to us, Father, Son, Spirit. When the first human is made, God pronounces it really good when they're together, you know, helping each other, and says it's not good to be alone. So Jesus, you know, when Jesus says, when two or three of you gather in my name, I'm with you. I think all of that is this real vision that we are called to community. And yet, you know, in our culture, we've made this kind of idol out of independence. I mean, we've even got a holiday, you know, like, but we believe in this kind of radical individualism that in some of the wealthiest corners of the world, we have the highest rates of loneliness and depression and suicide. So I think this calling to love and be loved, to live in community, is for everyone. And you know, the shape that it takes is different. Not everybody's going to live in a row house with 10, you know, folks. But, like, I think we can all find deeper community and reject this idea that we're just meant to be alone in the world.
And you've been called the leader of the new monasticism movement. Could you explain what new monasticism is and how that affects how you live?
Sure. You know, it's not the only language that I use, because if folks are not, you know, versed in church history, it may not mean too much to them. I mean, I've met folks that hear the word new monasticism, and they're like, I know you guys are a little nasty, but what? You know, but need a shower. But no, but the tradition of monasticism in the church has been these continual renewals, folks that often correct where the church has become imbalanced. And monastic communities like Mother Teresa's, you know, missionaries of charity, some of these religious orders, nuns and monks, they have a real rigorous discipleship of Jesus. You know, it's not just a belief system. Traditional Christianity is held together orthodoxy, where we get doctrine, and orthopraxis, practices. And I think what the monastics do so well through living lives of simplicity, lives of nonviolence, lives of service to those who are vulnerable. Often also they take a vow of chastity, right? Because the idea is that I want to live my whole life as if God is the pearl that's worth leaving everything for. And I love the beauty and the innocence of that. A few years ago, some folks got together, and I was one of them, to say, is there a new renewal happening in the church? And if so, what are some of those marks of discipleship? And so we put together a list of 12 different kind of core Christian practices. And that's, you know, all kind of what people talk about as a new monasticism. But I also think it's just a way of saying these are the core practices of our faith. And they involve things like caring for the earth, racial justice, nonviolence, prayer, sharing our possessions, providing hospitality to the stranger. So, you know, a lot of those things that we live out, we just try to put them into writing. And we've got 12 marks of new monasticism that came out of that.
And your way of life and your ideologies are being called radical. I think you consider them radical. But if it's really indeed a return to how Jesus said that we should live, should it be considered radical?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that the word radical means root, like radish, right? And so in one sense, I think rather than just thinking of radical as extreme or, you know, like wild out there, that we're trying to get at the root of what it really means to be Christian and the root of our faith. And the irony is, I think, that we've come a long way from what the early church really looked like. And I think what the church is meant to be, there are a lot of things that masquerade as Christianity today, but they don't look like Jesus. You know, and I think one of the biggest challenges in our culture is there's a version of American nationalism that is camouflaging itself as Christianity, but it doesn't look like Jesus. You know, you look at the things that Jesus said. I mean, you talk about radical. Jesus said, sell everything you have and give it to the poor. You know, Jesus said, don't worry about tomorrow. Live like the lilies and the sparrows. Jesus said, love your enemies, right? And so when I look at, for instance, the Beatitudes, this list of blessings that Jesus gives, he's in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek, blessed are the merciful, blessed are the peacemakers, for they are the children of God. And you look at that list, and that is a list that is the antithesis of the things that we often hear blessed in America. You know, these are like, we are literally often blessing the already blessed and cursing the poor. So, you know, I think that that's, I always like to go back to Jesus's teaching, and I'm struck by how radical the gospel is. Literally the gospel of Luke says the mighty will be cast from their thrones. The lowly will be lifted up. The hungry will be filled with good things, and the rich will be sent away empty. That's not Karl Marx. That's the Gospel of Luke. You know, so it is a radical call. I just think we're doing our best to try to be faithful to that call, and we're inspired by all of these, you know, great saints that are alive today and throughout the centuries that continue to give us a vision for what that could look like. You know, I think of in our country, I think one of the bigger dangers is we've sort of branded everything with Christian. You know, our money says in God we trust, and yet our economy often looks like the seven deadly sins. You know, we look at, and you know, I use the word inoculate sometimes, but when you get a watered down version of a virus, right, that's the vaccine that inoculates, knocks it out of your system. And I think in some ways we've got a watered down version of Christianity that for some folks it's knocking it out, and they're rejecting something that's not real Christianity, but it's this kind of a fluffy plastic thing. So I think, you know, for some people, the rejection of that is the invitation into a more robust faith. And that's what I've found for myself there. When people tell me they've given up on Christianity, I ask them, you know, could you describe to me what you've given up on? And as they describe it to me, I've rejected the very same thing, you know. And, you know, when they talk about Christians hating gay people and Christians, you know, that are saying all these terrible things, I'm saying, yeah, that doesn't sound like Jesus to me either. And I don't think it's a unique, it's no coincidence that Jesus's harshest words, like brood of vipers, were actually for the religious people who were self-righteous. He calls them a brood of vipers. And he says, the tax collectors and the prostitutes are entering the kingdom ahead of you. And we wonder what got him in trouble, right?
In one of your books, you said, everyone is a Christian, but no one knows what a Christian is anymore. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, right. It's taking a little spin on a Kierkegaard quote. Soren Kierkegaard said, where everything is Christian, nothing is Christian, because we end up losing that distinctiveness, you know, and so there's so many things now that sort of take on the language of Christianity. But, you know, I think that's why it's so important to keep going back to Jesus. I mean, the real test of something Christian is it Christ-like? Does it remind us of Jesus? You know, there's some countries where, you know, they're so post-Christian that no one knows it. But here, I think our bigger challenge is that we've kind of branded everything Christian. So we lose that distinctiveness of what it means to be Christian or Christ-like.
But I'm wondering about your the group you started, Red Letter Christians. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's related to this. So I had a friend, Jim Wallace, who was being interviewed by just like this by a radio DJ, actually. And this particular radio host didn't really seem to have a whole lot to do with Christianity, but he said, I have read a lot of the Bible, and there's parts of it that I love. There's also parts of it that I find really confusing and troubling. And he said, but I've always liked the stuff in red. And he was referring to the old Bibles, you know, that have the words of Jesus in red. And he said, you guys seem to like the stuff in red. You should call yourselves Red Letter Christians. And that, you know, that kind of stuck. We laughed at first, but I think, you know, what we've come to see is how unchristlike some of our versions of Christianity are. As Gandhi said, he's asked about Christianity, and Mahatma Gandhi said, I love Jesus. I just wish the Christians acted more like him. And so we, you know, at Red Letter Christians, we like to say we want a Christianity that acts like Jesus again, that loves like Jesus again, that says, what if Jesus really meant the stuff he said? And for me, Jesus is so central to the faith that Jesus is a lens through which I interpret the Bible. And Jesus is a lens through which I interpret the world that we live in. And that kind of, I think, is helpful, because anybody can take Bible verses and, you know, pit them against each other. But in this case, Jesus becomes the referee. You know, Jesus becomes the kind of sounding board for when it's something like how we welcome immigrants into this country. Jesus said, when you welcome the stranger, you welcome me. That has, you know, radical implications on, you know, some of the things that we might want for our country. And so I think that, you know, my friend Reverend Barber, he says, when we take our eyes off Jesus, we end up talking a lot about things Jesus didn't talk much about. And we don't end up talking about the things that Jesus had a whole lot to say about. So I think that's what we mean by Red Letter Christians. And it's a really powerful, growing movement of folks that are looking for sort of a spiritual home. So folks listening in might check out redletterchristians.org and join what we're up to.
One of the things that confuses me a little bit, perhaps you can help us with this. Jesus said that he came not to change the law, but to fulfill it. Can you shine some light on that?
Yeah, these are great. I wasn't expecting all these deep theological questions. This is wonderful. Well, I'll just give one very, I mean, there's a lot to say on that, but I'll give one really specific example. So for, there's a Hebrew scriptures in the Old Testament. There's a law, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, right? And so this was actually predated scripture. It was an ancient kind of framework for thinking about justice, that you could return harm for harm. Folks often call it reciprocal harm, right? So in as much as someone had harmed you, you could harm them back. So an eye for an eye. But we've often used it as a license for retaliation or revenge. It's literally where we get the word retaliation from, lex talionis, this idea of like you can return harm for harm. And so it wasn't a license as much as to set a limit. So we might say an eye for an eye, no more, right? If someone poked your eye out, you can't go poke both of their eyes out, only one eye for an eye, you know? So when Jesus comes, this is what's beautiful, is Jesus says, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, right? You'll say, Moses told you this, but I tell you this. And he tells us to love our enemies, a way that we can actually not return harm for harm. So we may have have the legal right, but that doesn't mean it's morally right. So Jesus, I think, it really expands that. And so, you know, we think of that now and you go, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Because if you poked my eye out, I'm not going to poke your eye out. We can do better than mirroring that, right? We don't rape people who rape to show that rape is wrong. And yet somehow in the case of the death penalty, we still are holding on to this logic, right? That we can kill to try to show that killing is wrong. And that's why, you know, I've really kind of tried to dive into some of these things in my book, Executing Grace, to show how Jesus wasn't negating the old law, but he's fulfilling it, right? So like stopping the spiral of violence was a great place to begin. But the fulfillment of that looks like don't even return harm for harm. And I think it's so beautiful and so radical. So that's how I would kind of reconcile those teachings and see Jesus as kind of fulfilling that.
So Shane, our country, as you know, has been experiencing civil unrest over the past few months, and protests have broken out all over the nation. But you've been participating in some of these protests, and you just marched on Washington, D.C. So can you tell us why you protest and what you were hoping to accomplish?
I like how Martin Luther King, Dr. King said, our job is to expose injustice so that it becomes so uncomfortable that people have to respond. And I think what's happening is that there's a cry in our streets that is causing people to respond. And it's a cry of desperation. It's a cry, you know, all over our country of folks that are saying, I can't breathe, in the words of George Floyd and of Eric Garner and so many others who, and so I think there's a racial reckoning happening in our country, and it's a powerful, powerful moment to be alive. So I was a part, most recently, we did a walk from Charlottesville, Virginia to Washington, D.C., 130 miles. And literally with the backdrop of Charlottesville, I mean, there's all kinds of history there. But most recently, we think of the white supremacists who gathered with the tiki torches, and Heather Heyer was killed there. And this was the anniversary of that. And we walked to D.C. and arrived on the anniversary of Dr. King's March on Washington, where we joined thousands and tens of thousands of others. Very powerful. It was also the anniversary of Emmett Till's murder in 1955. So all of this history is there, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what we're realizing is we can't get our future right until we get our history right. We have 400 years of history that hasn't been healed and even hasn't even been recognized to the point that we can deal with some of that. So it's like a festering wound, you know, that hasn't been treated. And I think that's what we see kind of surfacing in the streets. It's also the debates around the statues, you know, Confederate monuments. All of that is a part of that. You know, even in Charlottesville, the big Robert E. Lee statue that prompted all of that is still there. In Germany, after the Holocaust, you don't see memorials to Nazis. You see memorials to all of the lives that were crushed by them. You know, we don't remember 9/11 by putting up statues to the terrorists. We remember, the thousands of lives that were taken by them. But in our racial history, we still have monuments to the folks who were not the victims, but the victimizers, the folks who were on the wrong side of that history. And I believe that's, you know, some of what we see that now translates into lives that continue to be crushed. And one of the last things I'll say on it is, as we were marching, one of the responses we heard is we had signs that said Black Lives Matter. And many of us are white folks, but we were holding those signs. Is the response that we heard back very, very often was All Lives Matter. One person, as they were coming by, said, White Lives Matter More. For me, I think what's become really clear is that until we can say unapologetically and enthusiastically Black Lives Matter, we don't really mean All Lives Matter. Because 400 years of history has shown us something else. You know, we've called Black folks three-fifths human. We have corners of streets like where we were in Charlottesville, where Black bodies were auctioned off as property. In the Dred Scott case, you know, we had a ruling that said Black folks don't have any rights that white people are obliged to recognize. In order to correct some of that, I think we've got to be specific about that dignity and that justice. And so to say Black Lives Matter doesn't mean white lives don't matter. I heard one comedian say, it's like if your wife comes up to you and says, baby, do you love me? You don't say, honey, I love everyone. You know, we need to be specific and particular right now about racial justice, especially when almost every day in the news we see another child of God that their life is cut short by racism or police violence. And that you know, breaks the heart of God. It must break the heart of God that we live in a country that is sometimes more committed to protecting Confederate monuments than Black bodies. And that's what I think a lot of people want to see change.
Do you think that making protests is what it's going to take?
When I look at history, public protest has been a part of what has made change happen. And I think it's a symptom of something else. I think underneath all of this, there's a boiling up of pain, trauma, outrage at injustice. And that, just like water boils, that's beginning to boil. But I think what being in the streets does is it allows people to be visible, to be heard. And, you know, whether it's apartheid or, you know, Gandhi's marches or the civil rights movement, the suffragettes, like all of that, like public protest has been an incredibly important place. And, you know, for myself, I believe nonviolence is a part of what the power is, because we're trying to expose violence and hold a mirror up to it. And so we do that most powerfully by providing a contrast vision. So I don't always talk about it as protest. I like to say we're protestifying. We're testifying about how things can be right. We're not just talking about what's wrong, but how it can be better, you know? And so, you know, when Dr. King so powerfully, one of the reasons he was so committed to nonviolence is he says, that's exactly the power that we have, because they have all the weapons of violence. And he said, so you can put your dogs on us. This is Dr. King. He said, and we will still love you. You can burn down our houses and we will still love you. You can beat us and put us in jail and we will still love you. You can threaten the lives of our children and we will still love you, but we will wear you down by our love. And I think that's what we really hope, is that love in the end will win. And I believe that God's love is big enough for the oppressed and the oppressors. I believe that those who are filled with racism and hatred are in a jail inside of themselves. And I want them to be free of that hatred. And it's been said that Donald Trump didn't change America. He revealed America. And I think that's true. You know, that we really are seeing some things surface that were already there, you know, and police violence was already there. Racism didn't get worse. It just got exposed.
What does the Bible say about racism?
Well, I think that race really is a construct of privilege based on the color of our skin, as Michelle Alexander says. So you don't really have this concept of race. You have the concept of diversity and culture that goes all the way back to the Tower of Babel, right? So you had in the Tower of Babel, you had this monoculture. Everybody had the same language. You know, they were exactly the same. They were very impressed by themselves, and they built a tower trying to build a highway to heaven, really, you know, and then God scatters it. And that's where we get culture. You know, we get language out of that. But then you look in contrast in the early church in the book of Acts that we've been talking about a little bit. And it's so powerful, because in the book of Acts, it gives all of these different cultures that are together. And it says, as the gospel was proclaimed, they all heard it in their own language. And it says they were one in heart and mind. And so I believe that unity comes most powerfully in the context of diversity. We're as wise and beautiful as we are diverse. And God made us all with unique fingerprints and DNA. And so, I mean, we are a diverse people. And yet all of us are most comfortable around the people who are most like us, right? Racially, ethnically, language, religion, everything. And yet Jesus expands that. Jesus says, everybody loves the people who are like them. Love bigger than that, right? Love bigger than that. And I think that's the challenge of Jesus, is not just to love the folks that are like us, but to love as big as God loves. Jesus's longest prayer in the book of John is that we would be one as God is one. So it's not that cheap reconciliation. I think this is the deep gut, you know, heart work of justice. And it also causes us to repair the wounds of our history. Sometimes in Red Letter Christians, we say, if it's all white, it's not quite right, you know, because we want to reflect the diversity of God's kingdom. And one last thing on this is, I think what's happening in our country, on the back of the first Black president, the changing demographics of America, the changing demographics of Congress, is that there is a white anxiety among many white folks. There's a fragility, a fear, a longing for how America used to be. For a lot of folks, I think this is not, we don't want to go back, we want to go forward, and we want to celebrate our brothers and sisters who have a different shade of skin than we do, you know, and insist that they're made in the image of God as much as anyone else.
One of the things that you said was in one of your books is the danger is that we can begin to read the Bible through the eyes of America rather than America through the eyes of the Bible. Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that may have been a Stringfellow quote that he said, you know, we read the Bible Americanly rather than America biblically. Yeah. So, but that no, it's exactly it. I mean, it goes way back to this idea that God created us in God's image and we decided to return the favor, you know, so we make God into whoever we want God to be. We take the best that we like about ourselves and we project it onto God. And this is the gift of studying sociology is, you know, Durkheim had this idea of totemism, right? We project onto God everything we like about ourselves. So we end up actually just worshiping all the things we like about ourselves. So I think that's where we have to keep, you know, going back to the Jesus we see in scripture. And boy, I mean, the contrast of that, right? Of that the God of heaven in Jesus, I believe, came to earth as a brown-skinned Palestinian Jewish refugee in the middle of the genocide. Herod was trying to kill the young boys throughout the land. I mean, he entered into suffering, and his entire life is moving into the margins of this world to suffer with those who suffer, even to the point that he's executed, humiliated, naked on a cross. And so Jesus absorbs all of the violence of the world, everything hateful that we're capable of, and triumphs over it. When I think of violence, Jesus put it all on display on the cross, not in order to exalt it, but actually to subvert it. Right, to show us what we're capable of and then to subvert it with God's love. So and the profound truth of that I heard from actually the mother of that 19-year-old that I held after he was shot, and she said, "I get it, I get it." I said, "What?" And she said, "I've been thinking about Jesus." And she said, "God knows what it feels like to lose your boy." And she said, "God knows what it feels like to be me. God knows what it feels like to be a refugee, because God was. God knows what it feels like to be wrongfully convicted and executed, because he was. God knows what it feels like to be a victim of violence." So God, you know, is with those who hurt. And that it goes really to the heart of my faith.
One thing we haven't asked yet, and I wanted to find out, can you tell us how a community garden can help a community?
Well, first of all, we live in the concrete world in North Philly, and we had a fire that started in an abandoned factory, burnt a bunch of our land down, and we've been reclaiming all that space where dozens of houses were destroyed, and we so that's where we plant our gardens. And one day, one of the kids came down, he knocked on my door hysterically, banging on my door, you know, and I thought there must be an emergency, you know, a crisis. So I come out, and he goes, "Come here, come here, come here." He drags me down the block to point out a firefly, right? He goes, "What is that?" And I said, "My brother." He's like 9 years old or something, right? I said, "That was a great day for God. God was like, I'm going to make a bug that's butt glows in the dark," you know? And you know, and I think there's something about the wonder of creation, you know, when kids pull carrots out of the ground, where food comes from. And it's hard to stay convinced that there's a beautiful creator when everything we see is in ruins and, you know, and in concrete. And so I think part of, for me, part of what urban farming and gardening does is it's getting our hands dirty. It's restoring that earth. It's going like this whole story began in the Garden of Eden. But it ends in Revelation. If you read the last book of the Bible, it ends in a city that is restored, where the water is clean, the river of life runs through it, where the tree of life flourishes, where it says the gates are left open. So that vision, you know, that begins in the garden and ends in the city. One of my neighbors, I get some of my best theology from my neighbor. She said, "I get what we're doing with the gardens. I get what we're doing." And I said, "What?" She said, "We're trying to bring the Garden of Eden to North Philadelphia." You know, I really think when Jesus says to bring the kingdom on earth as it is in heaven, to bring God's dream down, I think it's for people to be able to grow food where we are, you know, to not to live in these food deserts, not to, as one young man I heard say, it's easier to get a gun in our neighborhood than it is a salad. We want it to be easier to get a salad than a gun in our neighborhood. So that's what we're working on.
And you turn guns into garden tools, right?
We do. Yeah. It's so, very related, right?
Yeah. So what happens with those garden tools? Do y'all use them in the community gardens?
Yeah, this won't mean much for the listeners, but I don't know if folks will see it on Zoom, but this is, I've got beside me here, one of our shovels that's made out of a donated gun. Even the wood stock that the handle's made out of is from the gun. We were inspired by the prophetic vision that's in both Micah and Isaiah in the Bible. And they cast this vision of beating swords into plows and spears into pruning hooks. It's this beautiful vision of a world of peace. But it begins with the people that are so tired of death and violence that they begin to transform weapons into garden tools to literally, you know, turn them from something designed to kill into something designed to cultivate life. So we got inspired by that and we started doing it. And our first donated gun was an AK-47, and we turned it into a shovel and a rake, and we've been doing it ever since. And it's been about 10 years that we've been doing it. So now we have a network all over the country called Raw Tools, which is war flipped backwards, rawtools.org. And we've got blacksmiths and metal crafters. We've got safe spots where people can donate guns all over the country. And then we immediately make them inoperable and we repurpose them into garden tools and other things. Like I've got a necklace here that's made out of a crushed barrel of a gun. Wow. So we're trying to make life-giving things. And what we've also been doing is inviting people who have been directly impacted by gun violence to take the hammer. And that's where it gets just moving beyond words. And it feels like when these moms and dads and young children take the hammer and begin beating on the red hot metal of a gun, it's holy. You know, my friend Sharon Risher, Reverend Sharon, she lost her mother in the Emmanuel AME church shooting in South Carolina. As she was beating on it, she named the Emmanuel 9, all nine of her family and friends that were killed. And she said, something happened inside of me. Like some of those wounds began to heal. All the anger that I wanted to take out on Dylan Roof, I took it out on that metal. So we've seen the power. It's not just symbolic. You know, I think though there is a powerful symbol in a, you know, this is made out of a gun, but it's also about honoring the pain and the trauma of our communities and allowing people an outlet for that anger and that grief. So we just did a 40 city tour all over the country, and in every community, we heard the stories of those impacted by gun violence and praying for the transformation of our country, just like we see the transformation of metal. It shows us what's possible. It doesn't have to be this way.
One of my favorite things you've ever said is we have to learn to disagree well. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So there's a lot of things that, we're in pretty volatile, politically, you know, volatile times. And one of the things I'm very convicted of is that self-righteousness is toxic. And it's nonpartisan. You know, it affects Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, but it's always poisonous. And you can have a lot of good ideas and be really mean. And I think humility, the ability to listen rather than to speak all the time, all of those are things that I see in Jesus, that I see at the heart of our faith. And we've got to make room for people's hearts to be changed. You know, I look at my own life and who I was 25 years ago in high school, and I was on the other side of half of these issues like guns and death penalty. And over time, you know, I've had my heart change, but it gives me a little bit of grace, you know, with other folks that I met a guy in Texas. He came up to me and goes, man, I got to tell you, I'm confessing it. I'm a redneck, gun toting, whiskey drinking, you know, pickup truck driving redneck. And he said, but I've been reading your books. And he said, they've messed me up. And I thought, man, isn't that beautiful? And I look at the table that Jesus set, and you had a Roman tax collector and a zealot revolutionary. I mean, these are people that didn't normally eat together, you know, but they're all being made into a new creation. We're all going to have some things we need to let go of. But we should speak our truth nonetheless. And I also believe in the power of stories. So much of my writing is stories. I don't know too many people that have been argued in to thinking differently, but I know a lot of people that have been storied in. And I think it's those stories that sometimes our problem, it's not an intellectual problem as much as a proximity problem. That, you know, if we aren't proximate to those who are affected by the policies, then that's how I think a lot of real injustice happens, you know, is that we don't know the names and faces behind those. So I think proximity means everything, you know, and to love my neighbor as myself means I care about policies that affect their lives. So this is an important time, I think, for our country, especially as I think of the scripture, perfect love casteth out fear. I think fear and love are like opposing magnets, right? They just can't occupy the same space. And the opposite of love isn't always hate. Sometimes it's fear. And when fear is driving our policies, we can do really terrible things to people. So I think that's one of our choices in November, but it's one of our choices every day, is what does it look like to choose love over fear?
So Shane, you're taking a sabbatical right now. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, after 22 years or so in Philly, we've decided, I mean, the good news is everything's going really, really wonderfully in Philly. And in some ways, it's just wonderful not to be indispensable. You know, there's so many wonderful neighbors and folks that are carrying the responsibilities that we're able to kind of dip out and be with our family. And I'm a mama's boy. My dad died when I was 9 years old, and I'm an only child. So I'm literally sitting at the bottom of the hill. My mom's texting me here, like, to bring me lunch, and we're hanging out and we're playing on the water. They live on the lake, and we were going to do that even before the coronavirus. So we're getting to do it now. We've got this school bus. My wife got obsessed with this whole movement of schoolies, right? There's school buses that are turned into tiny houses. So we've got a solar powered school bus tiny house that's mobile, and so we can drive it over to North Carolina to visit her family too. So we're taking a little space, and I'll be popping back to Philadelphia as well, but we're looking forward to the next season, and right now just enjoying being with our family. You know, we thought we'd look back and we're not going to look back and regret spending time with our parents while they were healthy and wonderful. Like we might look back and wish we had, so we're not going to live with any regrets. So it's nice to be living in, as Chris Farley said, in a van down by the river.
We also wanted to ask you, is there any question that you've always wanted to answer that you haven't been asked?
Oh, that's so kind. No, you guys have, you both have been wonderful and thorough.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Great conversation. Can't think of anything really. I'm really glad to be a part of the conversation today though. Thanks.
Thank you for being here today, Shane.
Thank you for joining us for Illuminations. Tune in next time for another interesting guest and another interesting story.
The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Red River Radio, our staff or advisory board, or of LSUS. Comments and suggestions may be addressed at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. This program, copyright 2020.